accession number 18481, reel 2.
Len Bradfield, reel 2.
Well, at Bobington, we started flying, doing air navigation, bomb aiming, bomb, and basically map reading and air reconnaissance. We did this in a series of flights in Avro Anson's. We used to generally do a cross-country flight and then drop 6 practice bombs at the end of that. As we did that, we used to find winds by flying on 3 different headings, forming a cocked hat, which was because we were using a bomb site known as the Course Setting Bomb Site, the CSBS, which we also practiced in a tower with a projector on the ground, which they called an AMBT, an Air Ministry Bombing Trainer. And you got quite good at actually finding these winds, and also quite good at finding things you could find winds from. So once we got that ascertained, you could do it for various altitudes and drop your bombs. But then this stage was when they decided that those above average on the navigation side would go as navigators, and the ones who got a higher above average assessment on the bomb aiming would go as bomb aimers. From then on, we went on to Upper Hayford, which was a operational training unit, OTU, where you picked up your pilot and the wireless operator who had already crewed up, and then you joined up with your navigator and your rear gunner, and then you did a series of cross-country flights night and day all over country, after simulating bombing targets, and actually you airdropped bombs on the places like Otmore Bombing Range and Sturt Flats, where you dropped 500-pound bombs on those. But these other bombing ranges, you only used to use the 11-pound practice bombs. We did that until the Christmas of 41. Then we went on from there to a heavy conversion unit, where we converted from Wellingtons, which we'd been flying at Upper Hayford, to convert to Lancasters via Manchesters, which was a very hairy time because they were a terrible aircraft.
What was so terrible about the Manchester?
Well, once one engine went, that was it. You know, the aircraft no longer flying. But we only had those for a short time in a conversion unit. Then we got fully trained with the Lancaster and were posted onto an operational squadron.
This cocked hat you keep talking about, is this a triangle?
Yeah.
It's just a fancy name for a triangle.
Yeah.
Can you tell me who was in your crew? Can you give me the details about the personalities in it?
Well, my actual navigator was David Jones, Welsh boy. He was a very precise and very accurate navigator. We got on very well with him. The pilot was Johnny Moss, who I'm still great friends with now. He survived. The flight engineer was Ernest Ronan. He was an old man, he was 32, married with children. Then we had the wireless op, who was a Canadian who'd come over to Britain, Sammy Small. And then the two rear gunners, the rear gunner and mid-upper gunner, was Terry Woods, mid-upper, and Ronnie Musson, rear gunner. Now, Ronnie Musson was married. Terry Woods was the youngest of us by quite a piece, and he was only just 18. David was as same age as I was at that time, we were 20. We actually gelled quite well into that mysterious creature, the crew. I mean, it's a thing you can't really explain what a crew is, but it's a sort of a relationship which you'll never get in any other form of life. I don't know how to explain it. You've got a sort of complete reliance one on the other, and you do practically everything together, you know. Because you don't get any real heavy drinking with them, for the simple reason half of them don't really like that sort of thing, so you don't sort of get out of hand. Gonna cough. But generally speaking, you stick in your trades and your with your crew members. I mean, it's you become very much insulated units. The only snag is that when you get anyone commissioned, they move out of the social side of the business, because my pilot was commissioned, and we did miss him on the social side because of going into town and one thing and another. And he had to sort of fit in there, into the officer's mess, which was a little bit different.
And which squadron did you...
That's join? 49 Squadron in 5 Group. It had a very good air officer commanding in that group, Cochrane.
When did you join this squadron?
In April 1943.
Whereabouts?
At Fiskerton in Lincoln.
Did you get any special welcome from when you joined?
No, you were just sort of introduced to your trade leaders, like bombing leader, navigation leader. Your flight commander. Your flight commander used to come and have a long chat with you and say, well, you're welcome, we're a crack squadron, we hope you all sort of fit in. There's a chap called Slee was the commander when we got there. He was an absolute corker of a chap.
In what sense?
Well, he really believed he could walk on water. You had these personalities about in these command situations. You've got leadership. You've never seen the like of it. They just sort of radiated it. You know, you've got people like Cochrane, you've got people like Slee, you've got people like Johnson. And, I mean, we did really believe that we could do the job. The main object of the exercise was to win the war, because Harris had taken over. They got a whole lot of aides coming in that we were actually getting effective bombing. This brings us into the period they call the Battle of the Ruhr, which we got Oboe, which was mosquitoes going over and dropping marker flares on a intercepting beam system, and that was backed up by Pathfinder force that put down coloured TIs to back them up, and main force used to hit the appropriate markers. It worked very, very well. I mean, the effect of the bringing the bombing into a matter of about a 5-mile circle instead of about a 50-mile circle. For some of the early bombing was absolutely a complete waste of time and money. But the Battle of the Ruhr was quite hard, and we were losing 5%. Now, 5% is 1 in 20 and when you're doing 30 operations, it does not quite work out mathematically. But that we always used to think that meant other people would go down, not us. We were firmly convinced that we were going to survive. In consequence, you didn't get an awful lot of pressure or fret. I mean, you used to lose crews, and you used to be very sorry about it, but they were just unlucky. I mean, it wasn't a case of being lacking skill or anything else, or the Hun being particularly clever. It was just that they were dead unlucky.
Did you come across members of air crews whose morale cracked under the influence of these losses?
Not actually on a personal basis, no.
Did it start to get under your skin?
No, we were firmly convinced that we were a very good crew. We got 7 aiming point photographs in our first 10 operations, and we were firmly convinced that we would go on, and then when we finished this tour, we would go on to Pathfinder Force, and then go on to as markers. And on that basis, we'd do 45 ops, and that would be it. In actual fact, we got up to 16 and got shot down. So,
before we come on to how you were shot down, can you tell me about any operations, specific raids that you were on that you stick out in your mind or incidents?
Well, our first op we did, we came back, it was over Dortmund, and we'd been under quite heavy flak in there, and we actually did an AP on that one. But when we got back, we touched down, and we suddenly swung off the runway, torn one engine off, and they thought it was a heavy landing. In actual fact, it transpired that we'd had a flak sprinter through a tyre. So when we touched down at 90 knots, we just went off the runway. That wrecked the aircraft, and there was a little bit of a poo-haw about it until they fished the wheel out and found it with a splinter through it.
That was the first operation?
Yeah. That also convinced us that we were going to get away with it. Because those ops were flown out to Sheringham and then off to Texel and then straight into the Ruhr that way, you know. They used to take between 4.5 and 5 hours, these sorties. So they were quite quick in and out jobs.
Any other raids or incidents that stick out in your mind?
Well, another good one was when we went down to Turin, which was a really long raid. We got flew down to Lake Anacin and over the Alps. And then we caught an electrical storm, and that upset all the compasses. And when we were coming back, we were having to try and do this as much as we could on visual pickup at the ground. And we picked up the Brest Peninsula. And I got a visual on that. And we set course from England from my visual. And going back across the towards Cornwall, we were going to St. Evel, we saw three other aircraft flying approximately 30 degrees towards the west. And there was a great discussion of whether we should follow them or whether we should stick to our own course. And David and I preached the fact that I got a good visual, and he believed it, and he was also getting a bit of a touch on G, which was another navigational aid. And we were right. So we flashed these other people with their oldest lamp to try and communicate. But they ignored us and carried on. And that was the night that Nettleton VC went missing. And we were firmly convinced that Nettleton was the lead aircraft of the trio we saw going out. That they had obviously got a wrong heading, and these other two had spotted who it was, and they decided they'd follow him. We reported this all at debriefing. But that was one of the principal ones. We also were firmly convinced we were good and we were right then. And then, of course, it came. We carried on through the Battle of the Ruhr. Then we then did the Battle of Hamburg. And that was quite a performance because on Hamburg, we've got this window for the first time, the metallic strips, which cut the efficiency of the German radar right the way down and reduced the casualties to practically nil.
Were you on that first raid?
Yes, I did the Hamburg raids. And it was such a joy to see the searchlight standing up there, not knowing what to do. We then went and did a raid on Essen with window, and that was the best raid we ever did on Essen. The actual concentration over the target was very good, and the actual damage was very good, and the casualty rate was negligible. We then went on leave after this stage. This is July, August 43. And we came back from leave and went and bombed Mannheim. Went to bomb Mannheim. And my friend Bert Cole and his crew went down on Mannheim. Of course, we thought they two were in the same bracket that we were going through. And the next night we set course for Nuremberg. It was down to Selsiebil, to Beachy Head, Littrepor, and then across into Germany by Mannheim to head for Nuremberg. Well, just outside a place called Bad Kreuznach, we were attacked by two night fighters. It knocked out the port outer engine with the first attack, which came from starboard high. Knocked out the port outer. That put the rear turret out of action. The wireless op went back to aid and abet the rear gunner because of this problem, because he had been doing fighter control from the Astrodome at that stage. But the aircraft broke away, the mid-upper gunner engaged it, and I engaged as it went over the top of us forward. At that stage, we were attacked again from dead level aft, and that set the bomb bay on fire. And we got the order to bail out. And I got rid of the escape hatch in the front, and the navigator and flight engineer were right behind me as I went out of the hatch. I went out without any flying clothing on. I was just in battle dress with an electric heated waistcoat, so I wasn't as encumbered as they were, who were wearing Irving jackets. But I went out there completely clear, and as I was lightly dressed, I decided I would fall to the underside of cloud. We were at about 20,000 feet when we were attacked, so I should think I went out at about 16,000. So I thought I'd better get down low, because it was only about 30 degrees below up there. It's pretty cold. And as I was just in battle dress and white frock, I thought I'd better fall clear. So I waited till I went to the underside of cloud and opened my parachute there. We got landed quite well in open country, never saw anybody. Hid my parachute, but couldn't make contact with any more of the crew, so I started to walk towards France to evade if I could.
What date is this that you were shot down?
9th of August 43.
Were you perfectly all right on landing?
Yes, no injuries at all.
What kind of terrain did you land in?
Open countryside, farmland.
Is this Bavaria?
No, it'd be a bit north of Bavaria. I think it'd be Pfalz, wouldn't it? I don't know what province Bad Kreuz now is in.
What time of day is this?
About 12 o'clock at night, well, 12:30 at night. So when the dawn started to come up, I decided I better go undercover, and we were in vineyard country. So I crawled into a A-frame. They'd grow the vines up A-frames, and I crawled up the middle of the underneath the vines and went to sleep, to be woken up by one of the locals digging me in the ribs with a pitchfork. So I said, "We have a Tommy." And I came out and surrendered, of course. But any alternative, taken down to the village where they had about a 12-year-old boy who could had some idea of English. And then they handed me over to a policeman who took me to the next village, which was a place called Volstein, where I spent the night in the SA, the cell at the back of the SA Brown House, where they kept the Jews. They had apologised for the fact they put me in a Jews cell, but it was nothing personal, you know. Next day they got a Luftwaffe NCO came down and took charge of me and took me to Frankfurt, to the interrogation centre, where we spent 3 weeks in the interrogation centre, where I was told that my majority of my crew were dead, and my pilot had identified me, but it's because he'd been shown my battle blouse, which was covered with blood because I'd been hit in the face with my parachute when it opened. So he had accepted that I was one of the dead, which I wasn't. But after that, I went up to posted up to Bath prisoner of war camp.
What was Dulag Luft interrogation centre like?
Well, you were kept in a narrow cell. They got quite heavy heating. This was still summertime. They turned the heating on and got you all sweating and hot, and then they turned it off and got you cold as you stripped off, etc. And they kept that up more or so for the 3 weeks, and people came in and saw you at odd intervals for interrogation, possibly half an hour. And then they'd come, leave you, then they'd come back again. You had to turn a latch down to go to the toilet, which was made things rather difficult. We were getting ersatz coffee and bread and jam for the main. That Kriegsbrot, you know, the that black bread of theirs. Well, we never could quite figure out the object of the interrogations. The simple reason they seemed to know more about us than we knew about them. We knew about ourselves, for that matter. But after 3 weeks, I was shipped up to Stalag Luft 1 at Bath, and my pilot had been shipped off to, being an officer, had been shipped off to Luft 3 at Sagen.
Do you think they got anything out of you at Stalag Luft Centre?
No, I don't. A simple reason, they knew which squadron we were on. I should think they most likely ascertained that from the aircraft. But there's no... They ask us a lot about number of raids and all the rest of it. Of course, you just said number, rank and name. Sorry, you know, as one does.
Whilst you were being transferred, did you see anything of the German population?
Yes, well, we went by... freight train, you know, we were in a boxcar, and we were left in the sidings at major towns each night as we went up. It took us about 5 days to get up from Frankfurt to Bath, which is just up north of Stettin. And the population seemed to be going on perfectly normal. I mean, when the village where I was taken in, you'd have thought it was a complete peacetime. There's no sort of military activity at all. It's just inside the old Siegfried line.
Was there any hostility from the civilians?
No. The only real case we got, really, of hostility was quite a lot later, when we had been moved from Bath to Hajdakruk, which was in what is now Lithuania, where we had to be as far away as we could from the west for our escaping purposes. Because the Russians were in retreat at the time, so were just beginning to get themselves sorted out, so they thought they got us nicely out of the way. But then the Russians started to advance, so they had to evacuate us from Hajdakruk, and we were brought by an old steamship called the Insterberg, which was a coal boat by trade, and we were in the hold. There was nothing made of that. It was terrible conditions in there. We spent 3 days in that, getting to Stettin. And when we got to Stettin, we were put into freight cars, and there was an air raid on Stettin, which didn't really improve the attitude of the locals. And we had Kriegsmarine cadets as our escort there, and they were very hostile. And but this time we'd been put in handcuffs because apparently somebody had been chaining German prisoners on the landings in France, because this is after D-Day. And had a German officer by the name of Picard, who explained to everybody that we were all Luftgangsters and all wicked murderers, and they had to do something about protecting their wives and children, etc. So these Kriegsmarine cadets, when we got out at Grosser Tischau, we ran us up the road to our new camp, was Telegluft 4, which is known as either Kiefheide or Grosser Tischau. And we run up at Bayonet Point, so we had to jettison all our kit we got, and arrived up there with quite a number of people with bayonet wounds and dog bites, to sleep in a compound with no accommodation at all. And the next day we were sort of sorted out into the wounded and others, and gradually put into the huts that they got built. But a lot of us had to go into these things rather like, we used to call them dog kennels, are about 5 foot high and about 14 by 12. And you used to put, I forget how many number of people, but you used to get quite a lot of people stuffed into theirs. But these were emergency huts that they used for temporary.